Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, podcast world. It's the Three Questions with Andy Richter. And I'm friendly with most of the people that come on this show. I mean, some of them I don't know very well, but I don't know that there's been anyone that's like an absolute stranger that's been on. But this is, I'm actually talking to somebody who's a very dear friend of mine today and whom I've known, I feel like since birth. Mm-hmm. Matt Besser.
Comedy birth. Hey, man.
How are you?
I was listening to Scott Thompson's episode and you call him an old friend. I'm like, oh, I'm way older than
that. Yeah, you are. You're like, no, really. You and I knew each other before we were even slightly grown-ups. Like, I think we were still kind of like kids, I would think.
Well, I think we're about the same age.
Yeah, I'm 52. What are you?
I'm 52.
Yeah.
It's funny because you were born in Chicago or raised there, and I moved there, and you were already part of the whole improv scene when I moved there.
Yeah.
And to me, you were like an elder, and I treated you like you were 10 years older, and you'd been around forever. And people tend to do that, even when they are only a year more in experience.
Right.
It's like... No, you were like an elder to me.
I was
for
like
a while.
A sophomore or a junior in improv terms, and you were a freshman.
Yeah,
it was kind of like, and yeah.
But you know what? You seemed more like a senior though, because
oh, really?
There was such a small scene at that point.
See, I didn't feel like a senior. I felt like there were other people that were like.
But when
more,
you're in a freshman, you don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's older than you.
Right. Oh, I know. And it's also funny to be like. They were the guys that like, oh, that guy's been around a long time when you first start out. And then you sort of see him perform a few times and you're like, yeah, and he's not very good. You know, there was like a few of those that I was always like it. You know, it is true. You come into this new thing and you think, and I had been through the same thing in film school. Like I'd come and started film school in Chicago and felt very like I knew nothing. And mm-hmm. I was very self-conscious and very naive and innocent. And then you just kind of figure out, oh, no, we're all.
Nobody knows anything.
Nobody, I mean, that's, it carries on through life too, you know.
There was so much, am I jumping into the.
No.
This is where I come from, right?
Yeah, that's yeah but no, you, whatever.
The questions don't matter. They don't.
Oh, really? I thought there was a right answer.
It's
and I've been really
it's
working on it.
It's just a way for me to just ask people personal questions.
You don't score us at the end and tell us if we win.
No. I just ask personal questions and then I hide my erection from hearing the answers.
Well, I could talk a lot about you, so I'll give you extra hard.
Oh!
But as you know, it was such a small scene. Think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I think we were so lucky that it was so small. We were so fortunate. Because that improv scene will never be that way again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, improv in general will never be. It was still kind of a weird little niche thing that you had to explain to people.
Without question.
We're making this up. And they'd be like, no, you're not.
Well, I want to ask you, since you were from Chicago, did you grow up knowing what comedy improvisation meant?
No.
When did you first know?
You must have
gone to Second City.
I never went to Second City until I was – that was not – A, I grew up 50 miles west of Chicago, which might as well have been 200 miles okay. west of Chicago. We went to Bears games, Cubs games, the occasional White Sox games, because for us, White Sox games were, the South Side was scary. Right. It's all just white fear. It was all just like rural white fear controlled everything. And also the notion of going to concerts. Like when my brother and I started going to concerts, and my brother's 3 years older, but we started doing that together because my brother had a terrible sense of direction and needed me to navigate. Like when he got a driver's license at age 16, I was 13. He didn't know how to get to like my stepdad's plumbing shop where he'd been going, you know, for like 5 years of his life, or he didn't know how to get to the mall.
That's nuts.
It's crazy. And I mean, at the time I thought it was crazy. So he'd have to take me with him to remind him how to get to the mall, which he has that. My dad has that same.
You're absolute, his GPS.
Absolute lack of direction. My dad's a brilliant, incredible, one of the smartest people I've ever known, but just, he can't find his way around. Like he just gets lost constantly. But
so I overestimate your knowledge.
Oh, absolutely. When we started going to see concerts, when we were like, I was 16, maybe he was 19. It was, you know, going to the Aragon Ballroom, terrifying, like absolutely terrifying to us. And, you know, and then you get used to it. It's like, oh, this is no big deal. You just find parking, you go to the shows, and especially because the.
I'm so surprised the same way, though, you probably went to the aquarium at some point.
Yes.
You weren't taken to Second City because it's such a staple of Chicago.
No, not. I was aware that there was Second City. I was aware that John Belushi was from Chicago. I was aware that Cheeseburger was a Greek diner in Chicago, but it was still a mystery to us.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That almost gives me comfort to know that you like, because in Little Rock, where I'm from, I certainly felt isolated from that. And I wasn't even getting to go to the Aragon Ballroom on occasion. Yeah. But anyway, I didn't know improv at all until I came there. I came to Chicago for stand-up, which was booming.
Yeah.
In the early.
I remember seeing you do stand up. Yeah. I think that was like one of the. Yeah. You and McCann were about the only people that I knew that did both.
Yeah.
And I would sometimes sometimes go with you and or with McCann to like stand up parties. And there was a very much a difference between improv
totally
and stand up
vibe.
And man, I was like, man, improv parties are loud and fun. Kind of weirdly competitive, and stand-up parties are sad. And like everyone kind of like quietly off in their own thing. And I'm like, it occurred to me, oh yeah, they don't play with others. Like everybody's their own little self-contained deal.
Let me tell you my first improv party. So it must have been after one of the first times I saw Harold, period. And I just must have glommed on and said, there's a party, I'm going to go to it.
And for people that don't know, Harold... Matt and I are both students of Del Close. Harold was his long-form improv game. It was just – it was a group game that involved scenes and games, and it all was supposed to kind of wrap up at the end, basically.
And I'd say at this point, the entire improv scene was probably 60 to 100 people at best.
Probably. Right? Yeah, I would think so.
And once you were in it for 3 months, you kind of felt like you knew – everybody.
Yeah. I mean, there were people at Second City who were actually making $600 a week at it, which was astounding and mind boggling. And you kind of would get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like the regular plebes of improv. Yeah.
So I went to this house party, and the best group at the time was Blue Velveeta. Mm-hmm. And they were indeed amazing. And
terrible name, but
yeah.
Good group.
They were like one of the last pun name groups.
Yeah.
But anyway, really great group. Jay Leggett, who passed away a few years ago, but big personality, really funny guy. Could be a bit of a stage hog, but could definitely just rule the stage and rule a room mm-hmm. if he wanted to. And then Noah, of course.
Noah Gregoropoulos.
Who wasn't on a classic team at that point that I remember as much. He has been on some, but at that point, I can't remember that. But was like next to Dell was like a general of the theater.
Yeah.
And also he was a teacher. Yeah. And also has this razor sharp, sardonic, dry wit.
Yeah.
Which he could use to cut a friend or a stranger to the core. And mm-hmm. I delighted in watching me. But that night, I didn't know either one of them. They were just two huge guys, and they're both really big guys. And when I entered the party, everyone was gathered around, peeking into a small bedroom, smaller than the studio we're in. Like, everyone was looking in the door, and those two guys were on a mattress that was on the floor, facing each other, and both red-faced and sweaty with beers in their hand, taking turns insulting each other. And it was just a snap battle. And I didn't know either one of them. So I didn't even know the personality that they were snapping on at that point.
Right.
But I could tell it was so ruthless and hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole house was watching it. And both these guys were clearly really funny.
Yeah.
And it was all done in good humor. Obviously, it wasn't a fight.
Right. But it's still, the whole point of that is to say the worst fucking thing.
Yeah.
Like to push the button.
Yeah.
Or the buttons.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was King of the Mountain too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was very fratty in maybe a negative way too, but still it was exciting. And
people will hear that and think, wow, that is mentally ill. Mm-hmm. Like, what a sick thing to do to each other. And what a sick thing to revel in. What a sick thing to crowd around a bedroom door to watch. And they're not wrong. But it also, in your young mind, being serious about doing this thing, not even realizing how serious you are about this thing, it is truly thrilling, truly exciting.
I felt I had found my crowd for this reason. I've been around parties where we're all chugging a beer and we're all looking into a room or whatever.
Right.
Or it's beer pong.
Right.
Or two guys are wrestling, or they're literally fighting and angry, and we're all hooting and hollering.
Right.
Or some dude's taking his clothes off. That's not quite my crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
I was there. I've been at that party in college and high school. But then I found a crowd where, oh, we're all being funny.
Yeah.
Like, that's where all that energy is coming out.
Yeah, and it's not just one person being funny and everyone's
standing
around.
It's the whole crowd.
It's everybody can fucking add to it. It's like you're not just, you know, it's a kitchen. It's not just one guy cooking. It's a kitchen full of talented chefs making a lot of fun. And it was, I at the same time, because I went to film school, and this was like very shortly after film school, and I would have mixed parties of film school friends and improv friends and my film school, like, you know.
Are we talking Columbia?
Yeah, Columbia College. And, you know, it'd be like my film school friends, you know, kind of gothy, you know, look, you know, a few of them are kind of gothy and a few of them are kind of just like young, sensitive artist types. And they would just be sitting over in a corner miserable while like a bunch of guys in Bears jerseys are screaming at the top of their lungs. And I'm enjoying the scream and they're saying funny, funny shit, but it is like really fucking loud. And my film school friends would be like, why are they so loud? And I'd have to be like, well, it's because you kind of got to be. That's sort of like part of the joy of it is being loud. Sorry. You
know? Yeah, the doing the bit and the bits never stopping is will really separate a crowd. Like,
yeah.
Who's enjoying that and who's like, I cannot fucking deal with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that point in my 20s, that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted the bit to go all night long.
There also was a lot of, I think a lot of it, there was a lot of mushrooms and acid and ecstasy and stuff. And I think that was, you know, that's as a parent, I doubt my kids are listening to this. Maybe they will someday, but like I couldn't, like if my kids said to me, you know, of course when they're like 18, but like, you know, should I do mushrooms? I couldn't tell him no, don't.
Oh, at 18?
Yeah, I'd be like, yeah,
that's
you
exactly
probably
when
you
I did
probably
it.
Should. You know, like it's I found them to be really useful and really fucking awesome.
I don't know about,
and showed me like I just remember there being parties.
I might direct
him
where to do it.
Right, right, of course. Yeah. But I just remember there being parties where there was something involved, some kind of substance involved. And they were like, we're not talking, there's no heroin, there's no cocaine.
I never did cocaine. There was some cocaine.
Was there? I never was around the cocaine. I don't, it was just more people tripping.
Yeah.
And I just remember there being parties where I was being funny in a way that I didn't even know I could be funny. There was stuff coming out of my mouth that like was like, you know, standing, screaming in my underwear and being like, wow, who's this person that's in me yelling this stuff? And, you know.
Shrooms can do that to an artist. Yeah. It can open up your mind and like for, you know, it's Jimi Hendrix or a comedian. It can flow sometimes. I definitely remember that too. I have vivid memories of that. We used to party at the Annoyance Theater, had this theater that was right on Broadway, and you could get up on the roof of it, and the parties would be up on the roof, and you could overlook the whole street. It was such a good time. And I remember, I think it was like an ecstasy party or shroom party, doesn't matter. And everybody was once again, I was the freshman. This is a very freshman story. Yeah. And because I wanted to fit in, and because you're used to, that's the other thing. We're all class clowns. We all were the funniest person in our high school.
Yeah.
And now we're all together and it's like, oh no, now I got to amp up my game to have people pay attention to me, especially when I'm the freshman.
Right.
So I remember this party, I believe it was Howard's birthday. And there was a cake. And someone had already taken a piece out and he had eaten it. We were past that. And the cake was still sitting there. It was like an hour later and everybody was going nuts. People were throwing beer around and throwing water balloons off the roof and shit. And I got the cake and I'm like, this is going to be funny. And I smashed it into Howard's face, and I'm the freshman.
Yeah.
And he's the most high status guy at the theater.
Yeah, he actually was salaried at the theater.
Yeah. And it's his birthday. I've barely done probably 6 shows at this point, but I'm a funny guy. I'm a crazy party guy. So I smashed the cake, and there's the knife still in the cake. I didn't see it. That he had this big old sharp knife that they'd used to cut the cake with. I smashed it to his face. It doesn't cut him, but the knife like clank. And I remember, I think it was his wife started yelling at me. Someone started yelling at me and it stopped the whole party. Like, you just smashed a cake with a knife into his face. It was such a freshman moment.
I was just trying to be funny.
Yeah, I just want to fit in.
We were all being crazy. Yeah. I just thought a cake in the face.
Yeah. Well, you guys too, at the time.
Yes.
It was you,
Horatio
Sands, Adam McKay.
Rick Roman,
who passed away tragically. Very funny guy. Rick Roman was kind of new to the scene and had a very kind of Andy Kaufman-ish vibe to him.
Yes. I would say he made Andy Kaufman look tame because I've never heard stories of Andy Kaufman in real life.
Yeah, yeah.
Like pissing people off.
Yeah.
Like Rick's The World was his stage. Like earlier when you're talking about drugs and Columbia, a story that popped in my mind is I went to the reason I said, oh, there was coke around, I went to a Columbia party.
Columbia College.
College Chicago. Party. And there was coke, and it was one of those things where coke is in the one room and everybody files into the room and comes out and not everybody's invited.
Yeah.
And we were definitely not invited in the coke room. And we were just drunk and being assholes. And Rick was going around touching people's hair and like brushing it like a dog and then walking away, and it would piss, and we were going up to them saying, oh, don't worry about our friend, he's on Super Cool, which is some made up drug.
right.
And eventually this guy wanted to kick his ass, and it was one of those, the whole party stops and the room clears for these guys to fight, and Rick is all wide-eyed, acting like he's on some crazy drug. Yeah. And he's just drinking
fucking around. Yeah, yeah.
And we had to talk the guy into it like it was a weird acid trip. Sorry, dude. Is this – like, this is when, like, Special K and shit is floating around. We're like, it's this new drug called Super Cool, and he doesn't know what he's doing, and don't kick his ass.
See, you guys – that you guys represented – that kind of energy, which is a pranking kind of energy. And you would come to parties, and and to me it always seemed like, because you guys were sort of still like the freshmen.
Yeah.
Like Adam McKay, who's got one of the biggest brains in the world, was still, he was in the same kind of boat where he was coming from, I believe, Pittsburgh or Philly.
Yeah.
Coming from Philly, had done comedy, but like is this new guy starting to do stuff. And very ambitious, very brilliant, obviously. But also kind of like, you got all these guys, you know, all these different Mikes and Jeffs in hockey jerseys, you know. And it's a very specific Chicago comedy guy kind of thing. And those guys don't prank. Like, there was no
pranking. There's a fight story.
Yeah.
You remember this?
And that's why I say, like, you guys would come to these parties, and I just sort of, I don't know, I thought you guys were funny. The pranking shit was always like, oh, it makes me so nervous. I'm terrible at pranking. Like, they had me do crank yankers once. I was terrible at it because I just identify with the poor person that I'm supposed to be pranking and end up going like, I'm so sorry, goodbye, and hang up, you know. But you guys would come to these parties, and I liked you guys, and I would hang out and talk to you guys, and it'd be funny, but you guys were, like, you did have this very combative group ethos. It was always like, hey, man, you want to go? And you guys would sit around with each other talking about fighting, never fighting, but just, like, talking about fighting and what kind of fighting you would do. And I just, like, and I remember,
I don't remember that.
You guys would do that all the time. You'd be like, I'd be ready to
but
go.
We
are
did.
You ready to go? Yeah. And I just remember, like, one time sitting with you guys and just being like, this is, all right, it's kind of funny, but it's really boring, guys. Like, come on. There's so much better things to talk about than fighting. But it would carry
Talking
over.
About fighting. I don't remember that.
You would do that. You guys would sit around and you would talk about, like, I would have your back if, you know, if, like, I was just part of the whole thing of, like.
Here's a story.
Because there were, like, guys. There were guys from the Chicago improv group who I remember being at parties being, like, we should go over there and whether it was you or Adam McKay or Horatio, you'd done something.
No, here's one.
You'd like,
so it was
broken a lamp or something, or I don't know.
It was an annoyance anniversary of co-ed.
Co-ed Prison Sluts, which is one of the longest running original shows in Chicago, possibly still running. I don't even know. Probably.
And it was very special, as it should have been, event for that theater, the Annoyance Theater. It was like the flagship show of that theater.
A very funny show.
Yeah. And it was some kind of anniversary for it. So they had bought a big layout of food. And I remember there was like shrimp and oysters. And that is not usual.
No. That's
spreads
like
spreads for us at that time.
That's jaw-droppingly expensive for us.
Where a hot dog at that point would have been amazing. Yeah, when there was oysters.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're doing the 25th anniversary, and they're doing a special show, and everyone's on the theater, is up in the theater. We walk in late. There's not enough room for us to see the show, so we go down to where all the food is. Right. We start eating food.
Oh. I'm remembering.
While the show is still going on, okay?
And you guys ate everything, right?
I don't know about that, but we're definitely getting into the shrimp and oysters. So, and we're last on the guest list, if at all. I think I was the only one invited, and I think I brought that whole crew. Right.
You brought your hillbilly friends.
Yeah, and none of them were invited. And Rick was wrapping shrimp and oysters and napkins and sticking in his pocket for later. Beyond just eating, like, I'm going to take the other stuff for home later.
Yeah.
So then the show ends, and everyone comes down there and sees us little rats down there, us little fucking wet rats eating all the shrimp and oysters and shit. And you can guess who said, I'm going to kick your fucking ass.
Yeah.
And I think it came down to Horatio and Mike. And I was in the middle, and it was going to be a fight.
Yes.
And it had cleared out, and it was in the front lobby, and it was like, we're sick of you motherfuckers coming in here. And then I got called out as sitting on the fence. Besser, I'll never forget this. Besser, you're talking out of two sides of your mouth, because I wouldn't choose, because I did annoyance shows, and I did. Right.
And were you dating somebody at the time?
I probably was dating Susan. Maybe,
I think so. Yeah, point? Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
So I was between gangs, and like I was like, "Come on, everybody, we're just trying to have a good time."
Yeah, yeah. We're just filling our pockets with oysters. who among us?
So yeah, that I'll always laugh at that one of the two theater comedy crowds in such a small scene.
Yes, yes. And also, one aspect of the story is that the person that was on the side of the house wanting to fight Horatio is a formidable fighter.
Yeah, the biggest guy in the scene.
The biggest guy in the scene, and also well-versed in fisticuffs. So yeah, it was going to be some tussle, you know. It could have been ugly.
There were fights out on the softball fields that I remember.
Yep, absolutely.
Between theaters.
There were a few people that had anger issues in those days.
You know, including myself up till now, but
I was including you.
You know, that's maybe the story of my life. But yeah.
I remember at one point saying something to you. I mentioned something about that I've never been in a physical fight in my life. And you said like, "Oh my God, I've gotten punched 1,000 times." And I was like, "Okay, yeah, I can see that. I can see Matt Besser throughout time not being able to hold it in and getting smacked."
I don't think I've ever hit anyone first,
especially
except
in
for maybe
Arkansas,
except for maybe Pete Holmey. That was a great fight.
Well, now here I brought it up, Arkansas. You're from fucking Arkansas.
Yeah, man.
You're an Arkansas Jew.
I know.
That's crazy.
That's very. That's formative.
Yeah.
For my dad, even more so.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And your mom, there's all kinds of crazy stuff about your mom being ostracized for marrying a Jewish guy.
Yeah, she was Christian and came from the, you know, Harrison, which is up in the Ozark, still very conservative place. And she married my dad, who was Jewish, and that did not sit well with my grandparents, and they pretty much disowned him. They were at the wedding. I wished I had this on film. My grandmother crying at the wedding, but usually people are crying with joy, and her crying with just straight-up grief.
Grief over, yeah.
Loudly.
Oh, it's crazy.
After the wedding was over, my grandfather took my mother's car from her that he had given her.
Wow.
In the parking lot outside.
In the parking lot of the wedding.
Yeah.
Give me your car keys. Oh, people are great. Now, was your dad from Little Rock originally? Were his people from Arkansas?
It's interesting because I'm about to do a show in St. Louis, which I've never done before. But that's where where all the Jews – We came from the Ukraine into Iowa briefly and then into St. Louis for a while, mm-hmm. the Besser clan. And they went – and they had business that went back and forth between Little Rock and St. Louis. There was a lot of we're opening up a clothing store in Little Rock. You can go work for my uncle down there.
Yeah.
And now there's a jewelry shop up in St. Louis. So there's a lot of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was born in St. Louis, but mostly raised in Little Rock.
In Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And what did your dad do for a living?
He was an investment banker.
An investment banker?
Yeah.
And did your mom have a job?
Yeah. She didn't.
And you have one brother, right? Older brother?
A younger brother.
A younger brother.
Yeah, he lives in Boulder now. But not many moms had jobs back then.
No,
it's funny you even asked that.
No, I know.
I can't even think of a mom who did have a job in Little Rock.
Well, my mom ended up having a job, but it was sort of out of necessity, and it was like an offshoot of my stepfather's business. So, but yeah, I don't even, aside from a couple of teacher moms or librarian, you know, like the mm-hmm. librarian, I knew her kids. But other than that, yeah, you're right. I didn't know.
I say that obviously jobs. From a place of upper middle class privilege, but that was yeah. my neighborhood. And that's right, who I right. knew.
So exactly.
Most of the mothers.
And what was it like? I mean, growing up, what were you, you know, a funny kid? Did you?
It's funny because I was funny to other kids, but never to adults. I was so shy to like anyone not my friends.
Yeah.
So I think I was very funny to my friends because yeah, I was yeah. comfortable. But like when I finally got into comedy, it so shocked my parents and my brother and people who weren't, they're like, that kid who just is so introverted. And,
yeah.
But in a class that'd be, I was the class clown. So yeah. 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 It's kind of a typical story that way.
Was it, when was it that you started, was it college that you started to do comedy?
So that's what I was saying about you are interested when you were saying that Second City was just a whole other universe that you weren't aware of. Because, you know, we're talking – being from a pre-internet coming of age is such a different story. And I almost yeah. wonder if our brains are going to look different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know.
Because growing up in Little Rock, I think if you had asked 12-year-old Matt Besser – like, how do you become an actor? I would have said, well, you have to be born to actor parents in Hollywood. Yeah. And that was my viewpoint. How yeah. do you become a rock and roll star? Rock and roll parents in New York. Like, and I thought I was going to be an investment banker like my dad.
Yeah.
And, oh, maybe in high school, I'm going crazy. Now I'm thinking about going into advertising. That's how nuts I was thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go to college and the whole fucking world opens up.
Right.
And it did. College, yeah. My whole world opened up.
Yeah.
And I didn't really think about anything outside of a...
You had the chance to play soccer in college, right? Didn't you? I don't know. I saw that. Like, they do research. Is that true? I guess it's not true.
It is true, but in a funny way. Because once again, pre-internet, if you're
recruiting... You didn't play soccer and you lied?
I did play soccer, but pre-internet, there's no YouTube clips. There's no, how do you tell a coach how good you are? And how do you know how good you are? Yeah. What are you comparing yourself to?
Yeah, yeah.
I played soccer in the 80s. You know that. Barely anyone played soccer at that yeah. point. How would I know to compare myself to a 15-year-old from Philadelphia?
Yeah, yeah.
We couldn't. I went to state in Arkansas. The state championship. My high school team was one or two the entire time I was there. Yeah. I started every year.
Well, and also
I felt I was great
for you. I mean, I don't know if people realize for in that what year are we talking? 88, 85, 84?
Yes, 85. I graduated in 85.
85. So for there to be a high school in Arkansas that had a soccer team means. It is the richest high school in Arkansas, probably. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Or definitely one of them, very few. So what we're talking about. Because
there is, in Little Rock especially, there is a fancy class of people. You know, yeah. like there is definitely like a kind of old Southern aristocracy in, sure. in Little Rock. Yeah, so you are coming from like the best soccer player in Arkansas is kind of a very rarefied air.
And I didn't even think I was the best. I just thought, but I was also going to a small school. I was going to Division III, and I thought, well, hey, for Division III, I'm fucking going to be awesome.
Yeah.
So when I'm going around doing the schools, I'm having the coaches walk me around the facilities like I'm good. They don't know I'm not good, and I don't know I'm average.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hilarious in retrospect because they were treating me like a star.
Yeah.
These are our fields, and
because you were on the team that won. Well, were you one of the best players on your team? Do you think?
Well, I wasn't even the top five on my team. But but in my mind, the top five were going to go to a Nebraska or right. a real college yeah, and be
yeah.
great.
Yeah,
And I felt like, oh, I'm going to like Ivy League type school. I'm going to Amherst, this very small school. So I felt like I'm going to be great there.
Yeah.
But I get there and the real athletes were playing with muscular bodies. We're playing. I tell this story, but like I was on the same floor as them, same dorm. And some dude was like, let's go down like the first day. Let's go down the fields and play soccer. And I'm like, great. And in my mind,
here we go.
I'm about to show off and get my first feather in my cap at how great I am at soccer. I'm about to find my people. And I go down there and I'm like, why are all these football and rugby players running down here with us? And why aren't there any skinny guys? And I realize they're all soccer players and they check you and they, meaning they fucking use
physical with you. Yeah, they knock the shit out of you.
And I'm like, oh, I've never even played like this before. And we're playing pickup soccer. I cannot hang with these guys.
Wow.
So it's funny. I got recruited in Amherst for soccer.
And did you play or did you get cut?
JV and sat the bench. And then I started getting high and played intramural.
Yeah.
The funny thing is I was one of the best in intramural. It's like I found my level.
You
always find your level.
You still got to be the best.
Yeah. You know what? Everyone should find that level.
Yeah. No
Why
shit.
Not? And
Why
whatever not? Yeah, you yeah, do. Yeah.
So did you, and is that when you started to, you like, did you, was it stand up that you started to do? And I mean, and
I have a weird story that way.
Yeah. Cause how do you get the nerve to do that? Like that's stand up. I hear these people say, friends dared me to. And I just am always like,
it was almost like
I needed
that.
Improv. I needed other people on stage.
I did radio first. So I did a punk show. And then doing the punk show, I'd just get drunk on Mad Dog.
And be like, belcha.
And start being funny and have people call in and think I'm funny.
Yeah.
And that kind of gave me the bug. Oh, people think I'm funny. And I'm have a. I think we literally had a 30-mile radius.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
like, people in Heath, Vermont, can hear me?
And they are very selective in
but Heath. It would always be like, hey, it's Mike from Heath. Hey, Mike from Heath. And I have a fan. And then you kind of are hooked. You're like, I have fans.
And Mike would call back every other week.
Yeah, and go, do the anchovy bit again. And I'm like, oh, they like my prank calls. So now I'm like hooked. But stand-up, there was a contest. We have a mutual friend, Eric Zicklin. He was my roommate or one of my best friends in college. And he was very writerly funny.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's a successful comedy writer out here today.
Even today, yeah. But at that point, he wrote in the newspaper and he like did the senior speech. So he was known for being funny that way. Yeah. I was still just, I only had my radio show. So that's how I was funny. He heard about this contest at UMass, which was like a stone throw away. If you win, you go to Jamaica. I think it was sponsored by, it was like Cool Ranch Doritos and Sticklets Gum, I think was the sponsor. And at UMass. And I know I'd never done stand up. I think he might have done it once or twice in Northampton. But we both did this contest. We show up, the audience is like, 2,000 to 3,000 people.
Yeah.
It's like one of those big college rooms. This is my first time going on stage. Usually you go on an open mic with five
with
other
a few
comedians.
Drunks, yeah.
And so it's packed with UMass students. The host, I won't say the host's name yet. So the host was a funny guy from LA and he was doing material. He was definitely a notch above us and doing material between us. I went up. I was so nervous that I was stuttering.
Captain Kirk, three-breasted.
I couldn't get the fucking microphone out of the mic stand, which is such a classic first-timer thing.
Yeah.
So I was stuttering and trying to get the microphone out, and I was killing because people thought I was doing a character.
A bit. Oh, wow.
They thought I was doing like Bobcat.
Yeah.
Anyways, that whole nervous energy thing. And then I just kind of went with it and just kind of just cranked it up and just, I was just loud and energy. And I had this script of material in my head and I was kind of just skipping around. It was almost kind of like probably sounded like freeform poetry right. of punchlines without setups. Like I never, but I have so much energy. It seems like confidence, and yeah. I think it. That's why it killed. That's what I'm gonna chalk it up to. But I did the best. Eric did the second best.
Yeah,
and there was like 12 people there. I read that there were a review came out in the UMass paper that gave us both a good review. Then I was hooked. I'm like, now I'm getting compliments from the press. I'm hooked.
Right, right. You saw your name in the paper. Yeah.
Zicklin sent me that review like years later, like 10, 15 years later. The host that night, his name was misspelled in the review. It said Judd Apatow. Did too much time in his in-between sets. It was a little critical of how much time he did his MC. And I was like, holy shit, Judd Apatow did my fucking – and I sent him that article. I was like, Judd, you know you introduced me the first time I was on stage?
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What was he doing? I mean, why was he doing it?
He was doing some national tour.
Oh, and he's like a stand-up doing a college date.
Yeah, and he was he was probably 2 years into doing stand-up himself.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's great.
But now, then I had the bug.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places. Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
I'm Phoebe Judge, host of the podcast, This Is Love. Stories about love and all of the surprising forms it can take. Like a man who finds a baby on a subway platform. A woman who spends most of her time alone until a fox starts coming around. And in one of my favorite episodes, we meet a man who forgot his wife and had to get to know her and fall in love all over again. Listen to new episodes of This Is Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Fluffy bread, fresh tortillas, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real, but Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love the most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and seriously great taste. Plus more of the dietary fiber and protein you want. No compromise. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HERO10 at checkout. That's HERO10 at HERO.co.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
Well, so when you get done with Amherst, well, what did you study at Amherst anyway?
American studies, which is basically history and English.
And was that going to be end up going into advertising? Was it going to end up being into?
My mom, God bless her, it was so important to her that I get a liberal arts education and not worry about
the specificity,
spinning it into my job,
yeah,
whatever that was. And I didn't really have a fucking clue. Like I thought I was going to go into advertising or something to do with investment banking. I took Econ 101 like my freshman year. I was like, holy shit. Just like soccer. I was like, this is fucking not for me. And I'm a dumbass.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all these, I thought I was good at, like I was one of the best guys in calculus in my school. And then I get there and I'm like, oh my God, I am so dumb compared to the rest of the people in this class.
I stopped taking, I think the last math class I had was sophomore year of high school. And then I knew I could get away with just doing science. Like I could understand science, mm-hmm. but math, fuck it. Numbers, no, thank you. They do not agree with me. So
it's weird when you're good at a skill or interested in a skill up to a, because I feel like I've told this, I've mentioned this twice or three times now. Like I enjoy the skill and then I'm all of a sudden realize, oh, I'm not as good at the skill as I thought I was. And then it's time to move on to a new skill.
Right, right.
But isn't that kind of what life is, I guess?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, but it is a personality type too. I mean, there is certainly like there are people who are okay being okay at something, and then there are other people that sort of insist on being really good at the things that they're going to do. And I think I'm kind of that way. Like, I don't enjoy doing shit that I'm just okay at, you know? I play golf. And, like, I definitely had to get to a point where I was better than – like, I'm not great at golf, and I can – whatever. But it's like when I sucked at it, it really bugged the shit out of me that I sucked at it. And I didn't just quit, which is unusual, because that's like me and playing a musical instrument has always been – this is frustrating somewhere between the brain and the hands. I can't get the guitar to do it. Fuck it. I quit. Yeah. But, yeah, no, I think that's definitely a personality.
That's weird you say that, because Judd, and that's bringing two thoughts together, but Judd's the one who made me learn how to play guitar.
Oh, really?
For Walk Hard. And it's something that my mom had also made me do, and I had hated it because of that. Yeah. I rejected it because it was this thing I had to do every Wednesday, and then I had to practice my scales. And
yeah,
I grew up hating. I didn't hate guitar music, but I'd hated the whole process of learning to play guitar.
Learning to play it,
but when it was for a movie, and Jake Kasdan and Judd are saying you have to do it, it's like you have to do it.
Yeah.
And once I had to do it, I was like, oh, I'm so glad they made me do this skill.
Yeah, yeah.
Forced me past the point where I normally would have quit.
Yeah. Well, you're getting paid. Getting paid to do something is always a good incentive to learn.
Humiliation, I'll tell you though, humiliation was the driving force. I think
to not be humiliated on set when you had to play.
Yeah. Yes. I did, and with all how big a movie and how many pros were around, I did not want to be the guy everyone was staring at.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you doing with your fingers? You look like a spaz. Cut. And then when you finally see the movie, it's like 100 yards away. You can barely see my fingers.
Right, right.
It's like, you motherfuckers.
Well, now, what makes you go from Massachusetts to Chicago, and how soon was that?
Well, first I went to Boulder just randomly because a friend was there, and I started doing stand-up there in Denver. And
for how long?
For just 3 months.
Oh, okay.
Just a summer. And then I went to Chicago basically based on – do you remember how many stand-up clubs were in Chicago in 1989 and 90?
It was Chicago and Boston.
It's crazy.
Chicago and Boston.
Guys,
and
there was like 12 clubs. I'm talking just in the city proper.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yeah. And it was at the beginning of the Conan show, it was Chicago and Boston. The writers and, you know, it was Chicago guys and Boston guys. And it really just seemed to be like – and the Boston guys were mostly stand-ups, and the Chicago guys were mostly improv, you know, kind of improv guys. So I think, you know, that was like a – but, yeah, those were the centers at that time of comedy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How's your family feel about I'm moving to Chicago to do stand-up comedy?
They were good that way, especially from where I came from, because I'd say most young adults my age were moseying into their first job.
Yeah.
Like that whole – year abroad, because
this is like
thing
less than a year after you graduate from college.
Yeah? Oh, it's immediate. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
So my parents were good with go find yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Not to mention my dad, he'd been in the Navy and he'd done his service on a Treasure Island in San Francisco. Do you know Treasure Island?
Yeah, I do.
That
I
weird
do.
Little island. And he was a radar guy when radars were as big as this window right here.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was a Allen Ginsberg, Ernest Hemingway wannabe. Like he grew up in that whole beat scene when he was in his 20s. So I relate. I think it's in my genes a little bit.
Yeah.
He instilled some of that. Even though he was an investment banker, he loved art and he loved writing. And I think he always – like after he died, I found these short story submissions he did to the New Yorker magazine that got rejected. So I saw that he had a dream in his 20s too.
Yeah.
And that's why I was saying earlier we were so fortunate to be in Chicago at that time when it was so – that scene was so small – and vital and easier to navigate since it was so small. And I just feel lucky. Maybe I wouldn't have met Dell if there had been 500 people instead of 100.
Yeah,
or met you
yeah.
and the people I ended up
I also think,
with.
Too, like there wasn't I mean, I think I've mentioned this on this thing before that, you know, my first improv class was just because I was working in film production and I knew I kind of wanted to write, kind of wanted to act, but it kind of was like I couldn't sit down and write because of my fucking attention issues. And acting, I was like, I've taken some acting classes and they just seem so artsy fartsy, yeah, bullshit. And like, why are we doing this? And so improv, a friend of mine started doing, Elizabeth Cahill started to do improv classes at Improv Olympic and sounded good. And I'd started hearing about improv and it sounded like something that would be good for me. Mm-hmm. And I'd started acting in a lot of student films. And I actually looked up Second City in the White Pages and called at one point when I was working in film production to say, like, how does it work? What is it? What do you do? And they told me, like, and I was like, okay. And then
it's so funny.
And it sounded so complicated and expensive and stuff. And Improv Olympic was just easy. And I already had a friend doing it. So I went. And actually, when I started there too, Tommy Blatcha, who was my roommate at the time, who ended up being a Conan writer and was a creator of Death Clock Metalocalypse and still does a lot, you know, still working in lots of really funny, weird animated shows. He came and he tagged along with me to the first improv class. And actually, Kate Flannery was in that first class too. Ah. It was all of our first thing. But a couple weeks in, I realized I'm sitting next to this kid who's moved here from Denver because he wants to be on SNL. Mm. So he came to Chicago to take improv class. And these are like things I was doing on a lark. So it was very weird to me.
I wonder who that person was, because that's exactly where I was coming from, almost at that same time.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Did I say? I can't remember. Yeah.
But you couldn't believe that, like.
I was like, yeah. Huh. I was like, oh, this was just, like I say, this is just like. And even when I was doing it, like, I remember there were different groups that we had. Like, we were in a group of us from the Improv Olympic had been, we were established in the Improv Olympic. And the Improv Olympic at that time was in the basement of an Italian restaurant. And a couple of the guys in the group befriended these owners, these two brothers that owned the restaurant. They got Sharna kicked out. And then we took over the space.
Coup d'etat.
Yeah, it was. It was quite the coup. And we were called the Comedy Underground.
Yeah.
It was a great group.
But do you know how much that move helped me, I dare say my career, but my comedy evolution? Like, that was one of my first opportunities.
Right.
Because you guys.
It was like 10 people.
The best.
10 people
arguably
from
the funniest.
The top
people.
Of the group left. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Sharon in Improv Olympic was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I have all my best guys just left. And then we were there. There we were, those little wet rats.
Yeah,
ready
yeah.
to prove ourselves. So that was a huge opportunity for us.
But within that, I remember at a certain point, a couple of the guys in the group who were much more career oriented held a meeting. We sat around outside the Italian restaurant and they said, these two guys are like, look, we said we'd give this thing, I don't know whether it was 6 months.
Yeah.
And if we didn't have jobs and if we didn't have agents and if we weren't getting casting people in here to a fucking basement of an Italian restaurant in Chicago, that we decided we weren't going to do it. We weren't going to do it. And we all went around the group. They're all set, you know, talk about yes and. We went around the group, and all these people are like, yeah, well, okay, I guess if that's how everyone feels. And it got to me, and I said, I don't have anything else to do.
Right. Like, what are we going to do in 6 months?
What the fuck? I was like, so if we end this, what am I going to, you know, next Saturday or next, you know, Wednesday through Saturday, I'm going to sit around on my fucking ass. Like, no, we're still having fun. We're doing shows. What do we care like about this? And then it went back around the group to like, oh yeah, I think that sounds good. If you're into it, I'd still like to do shows. And like the two guys that were really the ones that were like, we got to end this thing were, you know, like really upset that we all said like, no, we want to continue doing this.
And why would it matter to them anyway?
I don't know. It was manic. It was crazy. And one of them, when I said, like, look, we're having fun, and he actually said to me, like, yeah, enjoy your time in dreamland. And I was like, wait, it's a fucking improv group in a basement of an Italian restaurant. Like, wait, what are you talking? Like, the stakes, like.
Sounds like you're singing a Billy Joel song.
Oh, my God. And then, but then the two guys that sort of ran the thing ended up getting us kicked out anyway. So they, you know, it was like one of my first experiences of somebody with some power saying no. And you going like, no, I think yes. And they go, no, no, no. And then everyone around goes, well, how about yes? And then the person with power eventually tells the brothers that run the Italian restaurant, kick them out. And then they took over the space. Oh. And we went and started another group. Gambrinus King of Beer. Terribly named group, but it was because we picked the name at a German place, and on the wall there was a poster of Gambrinus King of Beer, who was apparently some German king who passed the first beer purity law in like 1200 or something. And that became, and I was like, no, guys, they were also drunk, and that became the name that we picked. So
there's a lot of beer on stage.
There was a lot of beer, yeah. But yeah, that it to me, I was at that time too, to me, was like struck by, we're just doing it to do it. You know, like, I don't know. Were you thinking like, I'm going to be on TV or, you know,
well, it just seemed like, but not SNL. I very much had the goal of let's be kids in the hall.
Like, yeah.
We were, because we haven't really talked about the UCB because this is all improv.
But that was
the family I was talking about there. That was Improv Olympic. We never even really did the UCB at the Improv Olympic.
Yeah.
But the whole time I was like, I want to be kids in the hall. I love those guys. And they did it. Why can't we do it?
Yeah.
So that's what we said. And that's why we started doing shows.
But how does UCB start?
And there used to be this place.
Adam's in it, right? Adam McKay's in it. Ian Roberts, Amy.
Amy's not as old as us, but you remember the Roxy. There was this place that had a great open mic. I'd say probably Conan started there and Bob Odenkirk and a lot of people started there.
Yeah.
And Andy Dick and Dino, there's a lot of people.
Dino Stamatopoulos, yeah.
Once again, it's like looking back on that room where I just named what could have been the lineup on an open mic, you know? And now look at all those people, you know, and to think. But anyway, I was doing bits there, and it was like you just see people with a similar sense of humor. McKay's like, that's funny. Can me and Horatio do something with you guys next week? It was me and Walsh. And then you see Ian improvise. He's like, hey, you want to do something with this? So it was like that at first. And then we did this show called Virtual Reality, which at that point, no one even knew what virtual reality was. It was like this cyberpunk kind of concept. Mm-hmm. But we did this whole virtual reality show, and it got good reviews. And it actually brought people to the show, and it gave us confidence of, hey, maybe this thing will work. But in short, that's how it started, was just one show that actually worked. Because in Chicago, it's like there's so many different shows to get more than 20 people in the audience. If you achieve that, you're like, oh, I got something going here.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're also too – you have to go out and stand on the fucking street in front of the L stop and hand out 2-for-1 drink tickets to try and get people to come to these shows. I mean, that's like a whole added extra side to doing – these fun shows in places is that it's tough to get people to go there and see it, you know? And I mean, I remember
how do you overcome inertia?
Yeah.
No one knowing who you are.
Well, we had a rule too there at the Comedy Underground, like there couldn't be less people in the audience than there was on stage. And there was a couple times where we had to not do a show because there were fewer people in the audience than there were on stage. And that was just, no, you can't do that. So
what happens when you walk half the audience and then in the middle of the show, there's less audience than people on stage?
I think once you commit to start, you gotta start. Now you guys, so did you then, was it pretty much at the Roxy? Did you had different look? Cause I remember I had left town at that point. I was in New York doing a show. And you guys did some show with, and I remember it like involving walking the audience around.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And was that like one of the first uprisings?
We rarely
did the same venue twice. Yeah.
And we shut down a few venues too.
In what sense?
First venue we were to a Cabaret Voltaire. Yeah. We got kicked out for putting our beer in their lettuce crisper and giving the audience alcohol punch, distributing it.
Okay.
So Second place.
You're prejudiced against, they're prejudicing its hospitality. I mean, come on.
Some of the things we did were like, what are we doing? There's this place called Kill the Poets. Do you remember that?
I remember the name, yeah.
That place closed.
A very, very funny name. We're like, that name says comedy.
That Kill name is like, are you just trying to get people not to come to your place? Then there's a place called Rudely Elegant. That's where we did virtual reality.
See, that just sounds like a furniture store, you know?
That was on like north of Milwaukee, I think.
Yeah.
And then the one you're talking about, we called the virtual tour, where we had a map, and it started downtown. We'd walk down, what's it called? The Miracle Mile.
Yeah.
And at certain stops, it'd be like, I think there's like a church down there, and it'd be like, we'd do a church scene, and then we'd walk in front of a jewelry store and do a jewelry store scene or whatever.
On the sidewalk in front of the place?
Yeah, we incorporate the world into the scene. And
are they improvised? Or are they written? Or are they sort of loosely written?
I think it was loosely written.
Yeah.
Yeah, that show in particular. The point of that show was, wouldn't it be cool to walk around with an audience and do scenes?
Yeah, yeah.
And it got people. I'm almost sort of amazed in retrospect. I know how hard it is to get an audience in LA and New York. It's like, wow, in Chicago, we were unknown and we had people walking around with us, like 30 people. How do we get them to do that?
Now, how does that happen? And at that point, this is you and Walsh and Horatio and Ian and Adam McKay.
Walsh went in and out.
Yeah.
Ian was in every show. McKay was in every early show. Horatio was in and out because Horatio got on Second City. And then Walsh was doing a lot of annoying stuff in Second City. And then Amy came to town at some point, you know, and she was the freshman. And we'd always needed a little female influence in the group. We'd asked.
Every group did. It was such a white boy game at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. There just weren't many women, period. But anyway, when she joined us, McKay got SNL and that kind of gelled the final four. And Horatio got SNL, so he couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So then the final four of like, let's go to New York and make this TV show. That's how that kind of.
Did you sell the TV show before you came to New York, or did you all decide to come to New York?
We started doing it back then. Maybe it's still this way, but showcasing was so important. And it really was like waiting for Guffman. It was like, is Guffman going to be in the audience? And if it was in Chicago, Guffman was rarely there. So you had to go to LA or New York. So we would do these showcases in New York where you'd get a lot of industry there. It was really intimidating.
Yeah.
And then the Aspen Comedy Festival was around back then too.
Yep.
And they really did scout the whole comedy world. They really did get the cream of the crop. And then you get there and it was highly competitive and we did really well there. And then Comedy Central pretty much, based on our performance there, bought us. And that was soon after we moved to New York.
Oh, it was after. You know, guys. Yeah, because I remember you guys came to New York. I had been in New York. I had been in L.A. And then I was back in New York. And the Conan show, I think, was just starting at that point. Or it had been on for maybe a year. And I remember, I think your first show was in a basement somewhere down.
Yeah, Tribeca Lab.
Yeah, it was like in a basement. And I remember seeing, and I had, because I had missed out on this, that particular evolution.
Right.
Like I say, I had just heard about these shows that you guys were doing. And so it was, it was really fantastic, you know, and different, really, truly different than a lot of stuff that was happening on stage in comedy. And also, there's just the four of you are just brilliant, brilliant people, amazing.
Thank
performers,
you,
and we at the Conan show immediately took advantage of that, to bring you guys in. And it was me. And yeah. I think maybe, I don't know if Stack was there at the time, but it was me definitely saying, and I didn't know Amy and I didn't know Ian really, because mm-hmm. they were sort of the newcomers after I'd left. But I was like, I got funny people here. Because mm-hmm. one thing that fucking blew my mind, I got hired on the Conan show and I didn't know anything and mm-hmm. I didn't, and all of a sudden I'm like, and I was improv. So now I'm writing sketches for a, you know, for the show that's replacing David Letterman. Mm-hmm. Totally fucking daunting. You have to just kind of like, okay, I'm doing this. And I'd write sketches. They would bring in, and I would think, okay, this is New York City. Well, I'm going to see some talented mm-hmm. fucking people. Unfunny motherfuckers, mm-hmm. one after the other, and just be like, look, I'll just get Dino to do it. You know, we ended up just having the writers do these bits because
but
we
there
get,
was a logic to it, and it's why our theater succeeded there. There was no improv there at all.
Yep.
But the improv that was there was like literally 20 years behind.
Yeah.
To do comedy, you had to be pretty much established stand up to get into a legitimate stage. Otherwise, yeah. you're in just doing a bar open mic. No places to do sketch unless you're going to rent the space for $300 to $500 a night.
Yeah.
So there was nowhere for that talent to find itself,
yeah, to
like
foster
in Chicago.
Itself. Yeah. No, we were just getting people that, like, you know, equity actors that come in that, like, you know, because they had been in Kiss Me, Kate, they said they could, you know, do comedy. And then you guys came, and I was like, okay, we got to bring these in. And everybody on the show immediately, all the writers on the show realized, okay, I wrote a bit. It is this amount of funny. And we can hire any one of these four guys. It'll be guys, and I include Amy as a guy.
Yeah.
Because guys, y'all. It's a gender thing. Yeah. Or it's a gender neutral thing for me. And you'll add percentage to the top of being funny. You know, like you bring in Amy, bring in Walsh, and the bit that you've written is made funnier, as opposed to hoping that the person that you hire will at least wring the amount of funny that's just there on the page out of it. And it was, I think it was a huge change for us. And then as you guys, at what point did you start teaching classes right away?
Yeah.
Because then we started
asked, like saw us do an Ask Cat that we did just for fun.
Another,
like,
long form improv show.
Yeah. And they were like, how do you do that? Just like I had asked at one point.
Yeah.
How do you do that? So then, and we had no jobs. I was about to say to you that without getting those jobs from you guys and our teaching work, I would have had to get, I know, I'd have to go back to waiting tables or being a substitute teacher. So I didn't have to do that.
Thank God.
Hey, man, I did that all through my 20s.
Believe me, I know. I know.
So anyway, that it was good to have those kind of jobs in New York.
Yeah.
Rather than have to scour for jobs I enjoyed less.
Well, then, you guys started taking these classes, and then that opened up to all of a sudden there were people that you were taking classes with you guys that then we could use on people like Andy Daly, yeah, and Rob Riggle and Rob Corddry and
there are other Robs.
Yeah, all the Robs. And
thousands of Robs we brought to you.
But it was, I mean, it was really, it was fantastic for us because all of a sudden it's like you guys somehow like sent out a signal, like a bat signal to people that were going to be funny in that particular way.
Yeah, I'd rather credit Dell here, but he, because that's the same epiphany I had with his, like, and you were talking about acting classes earlier and how boring they were. And when I would
this
take.
This is Dell, again, this is Dell Close, who's like the improv guru of.
I had taken all those acting classes too and been so not inspired by them.
Yeah.
It felt like either I'm not getting this or I'm not a good actor. It made self-doubt and the techniques and methods never made sense to me. And all of a sudden I got in a class with this guy, Dell, and he started talking about – however he talked about finding the game, just talked about how comedy works, how comedy can come from – real life. And all of a sudden I was like, holy shit, this makes sense to me.
Yeah.
It's clicking. He's not making me funny at all.
Yeah.
But he's giving me a method of working with other people and us all raising our level of comedy.
Yeah.
And all those people you just named, the same thing. They all existed out in New York and they were all funny. They didn't have any place to do it together,
right,
a system to do it
with
each other. So, yeah, I completely Del changed my life in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Now, when you say self-doubt, in that early part, is there so much stuff building that that self-doubt doesn't creep into it, that you feel like, okay, we're going to start this school and we're going to, because, I mean, you guys, and I've said this before, you know, you guys have created one of the most vital performing institutions.
We had zero goal to, as you know, didn't come to New York for a goal of opening a theater or even a school. It just all came organically. So I guess there's no doubt when every move you make is being forced upon you. Even for better and for worse, even up to this year, that's been a nightmare for me. Like everything that happened to us was like, wow, we sure spent a lot of money renting class space. It'd be better if we got this space for a month instead of every 3 days. Oh, wow. We spent a lot of money renting it for a month. It'd be better if it was just ours.
Yeah.
Like we're every show in this guy's theater right now, the Soul Arts Project.
Remember yeah, that? Yeah.
And it's like, look, all this money we're spending. We're being stupid. If we could rent it for this much less across the, you know, that's how every decision happened.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, but is that scary? We got closed down.
When you sign a lease for a thing, how do you, I mean.
I wish it, my lesson of this year is I wish I had felt the fear I should feel with leases.
Yeah, yeah.
But that time, oh my God, Andy, all the stuff we did in that first theater and how much a fire trap it was, and so many theaters in New York are.
Yeah.
There's no alleys in New York, folks.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you get out the back?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You could say that of a ton of small theaters in New York.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the fire department shuts you down. And then you're like going, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The landlord told us they get out by getting on the next building's roof. And this is how you do it. And the firemen come in and go, what? That's not a plan. Escaping to another roof. You guys can't do a theater here anymore. So then we had to get a bigger theater. So you know what I mean? It wasn't it didn't come from, hey,
it's just necessity.
Let's go get a bigger theater. It came from, you guys get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Now we got to make a new decision.
Yeah.
And all of us wanted to be and remain wanting to be comedians. We don't want to be theater owners.
Yeah.
We didn't have that goal. So everything that's happened to us for better and for worse is like, someone working for us telling us, hey, it's gotten to this point. Do you guys want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Yes or no?
Yeah.
And it's usually yes. It's like, okay, that's what you guys think. We'll do it.
Yeah.
Like you said, wasn't it intimidating to sign those leases? It wasn't. And then all of a sudden that caught up with us of like, wow, we should have been looking at these leases in New York harder.
Yeah.
Because, they are scary.
Well, now you have a special coming out, right?
Yes. It's called Pot Humor. It's an amalgamation of all these 420 shows I've done at our theater through the years and festivals I do. I got a ton of weed humor.
You're the Cheech and Chong.
Yeah, baby. I went up to Portland. There's this Northwest Cannabis Club. It's one of the very few places you can actually get high and watch a show.
Yeah.
And this whole audience just baked out.
Right.
And they were so high. I do a lot of interactive stuff at the beginning of the show where they could barely, like, I've done this a lot with interacting with the audience and talking to them in this 420 show. This is the first time that they're literally baking during the show. These guys could barely talk. It was almost funny just for that reason. I had my wife there in the audience.
Who does not smoke weed, does she?
On occasion, but not much. Yeah. But not all the shows about weed. And I get into this riff about eating pussy. And I'm like, you can't, you know, I used to be able to say that in front of, I would say it in front of my wife in the middle of the day, but now we have a kid and I can't say that anymore. So I'm going to this riff about you have to talk in code. And I talk to the audience, like, what code would you use to say it? And then I go to my wife and I'm like, well, does any of that work for you? And everyone doesn't know she's there up until that moment.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They're all freely just saying, eating at the bakery or whatever. And it's like, right. Let's ask her. And everyone went, ooh, she's actually here.
Yeah,
the woman
yeah.
we're talking about. That's the pussy being eaten.
Yeah, yeah.
It's become real. It's not abstract anymore. I'm not sure if I've ever seen a stand-up go, and this is my family I've been talking about the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know it's, yeah, because it's very fucking uncomfortable. Knowing stand-ups who do bits about their family, it makes my fucking skin crawl sometimes. It's ridiculous.
There's this guy, please watch it, folks. You can get on Amazon or Xbox, all those VOD places, Apple TV. But when you do watch the scene with my wife, there's this guy sitting next to her whose eyes are closed. And when I start doing the bit that night with her, and, you know, I know it's all being filmed, I'm like, oh, my God, this dude is sleeping right next to my wife. And how am I going to edit him out?
Yeah, yeah.
But then as the bit goes on, I see he's not sleeping. He's so high, his eyes are closed, and he's kind of grooving, you know, like when you groove to a jam at a concert and you kind of just close your eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was grooving to my
to
comedy.
The comedy. Dude.
You got to see it. And he does groove to it. I'm not even making up because you can see it. He's like rocking back and forth in his seat. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is what I wanted, man. An audience that gets so high. They find the rhythm of my jokes.
They can't look at me. Oh, man. Well, now, I mean, UCB is now such a big, and like I said, the most, I think, one of the most vital performing educational institutes in the country now. There's been some growth issues. You know, you were on both coasts and you had to, didn't you have to close one of those theaters on the...
Well, when you brought up leases, like we had a lease that was a son of a bitch in the East Village that the reality of it hit us suddenly. And it was like, oh, this thing that I signed.
Yeah.
It made me stop signing things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a big life lesson of like, wow, you trust people and people say it's this way. And then you realize, oh, it wasn't that way at all. And this is a bitch.
Is it like continuing pretty well? I know there's been like lots of controversy.
Yeah, even that venue that closed, we found a new, better venue, at least the way the stage is, and location's called Subculture. New Yorkers, check it out. Our new second venue, and we're still in Hell's Kitchen in New York. But yeah, we've gotten back on our feet, but this has been a year of me being involved in the theater way more than I want to. I do just want to be a comedian and do my pot humor special and talk about that.
I
don't enjoy all the bummer parts of running the theater at all.
Well, but I mean, all four of you have going careers that don't allow you to just like run the theater. So it's kind of
and from the beginning, we've always said that. It was like, we did not get into this. So we are hiring people to run this theater.
To run the theater, yeah. But now how do you supervise, like just the basic ethos of what's going on there, that you still agree with it? Or is it just, you check in with shows?
The ethos is the one thing I think I have always kept my foot in the river on, because I didn't want whatever the types of shows we wouldn't have, or even stuff like stupid shit like pre-show music. Like, yeah. It bugs me when we play mainstream music, when it's like, I want the music to be like the comedy we're putting up.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And, but I was never into monitoring the business side. None of us wanted to do that.
Yeah.
But when you say ethos, that's more like the philosophy behind the school and the performance, I'd say. So yeah. I've always been interested in that and kind of fascinated by it in a way.
Right.
Some interest in comedy that way.
Well, how do you guys handle, though, having to make sure that it's, that the business is the business and that the money is,
it,
you know?
It sucks, man. I don't handle it. This year's been awful.
Yeah.
I'm not handling it well at all.
Yeah.
I've handled it as well as I could. But it's like the death of a parent. It's like, you don't want to have, it's awful. And then you don't want to have to deal with it, but you have to, and it changes your life and you have no choice.
Yeah.
Versus having a job that you can walk away from that you don't like or something like that.
Right.
Like, there's certain things in life you can't walk away from.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of them.
Yeah.
And it's been a bummer of a year that way.
Yeah.
But it's been positive in that our staff is so great and we have turned ourselves around.
Yeah. And ongoing, is there, is it just kind of keep it going the way it is? Are there any more growth plans for the theater? Or are you just,
I'll be honest, this year's been about simplifying it more than growing, in that we feel that we're the best comedy school and the best comedy theater. And we were doing stuff like worrying about making branded content videos. Like,
yeah.
we were in, you know, everyone was into that game.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the bottom
I was in one of them, or, you know, the Christmas.
Oh, yeah. The CISO thing in particular, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to still be in that kind of bigger game, but we were in the smaller, like, just making whatever ads for a company, just like everybody.
Oh,
was.
I see.
The
what
funnier
you mean. Yeah,
guy
yeah.
kind of model. And then that market kind of just dropped out for everyone, and we had put too much into that, and we felt like, why were we that wasn't us.
Yeah.
Like, let's get back to the school and the theater.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I guess the growth comes in making opportunities for education to the rest of the country. Like, we have an online sketch class we just started.
Oh, cool.
We do one-on-one tutoring with sitcom scripts that you can do in the middle of the country, stuff like that. Our improv manual, stuff like this. So that's where we see the growth. Right now we're doing an audio book that you can hear anywhere in the world versus just the United States, where our book is only available now. So I guess that's where the growth is with the education.
Mm-hmm. Now, for you personally, when you know, like, ongoing, like you said, you just want to be a comedian, but you kind of have this business you're running. I mean,
yeah, I even hate answering questions about UCB. Like, I like it gives me.
Well, then you shouldn't have started a school, asshole.
But that was the thing. I didn't start a school. I tried to save money by not spending as much on class space I was renting. That's the way we
started
looked at
a school.
It.
You started the best comedy school in the country, asshole. You have to fucking follow it now.
But I don't. I want to be. If you're asking what I want to do,
yeah,
moving forward,
yeah,
I like doing comedy experiments, like what you're doing with me later this week.
Yeah.
Like, I've invited you to do so many times, and I thank you for doing through the years. Like, I like doing shit like that. I like trying something, going, I've never done a musical before, I'm going to try that. I've never done a movie before, I'll try that, you know,
mm-hmm.
Whatever it is. I like doing that. I like challenging myself that way.
Yeah.
You're not always giving every opportunity you want, and that's showbiz, but that's what I want.
Yeah.
And what's great about this world we're sitting in right now, the podcast world you greeted at the beginning of the show is we are in an affordable world where I can do experiments and I don't have to wait for Ted Harbert at NBC to approve.
Which
my
you've
ideas.
Been doing improv. You've been doing an improv podcast and for many, many hours of improv comedy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Improv for humans.
Improv for humans.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad about that because back when we started, once again, before the internet, just to think that the only way I can be seen is to get on that stage tonight.
Yeah.
And now there's other ways. So you can create your own reality, your own career to a degree. You still have to find fans and stuff.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah. And now, and going into the what have you learned part of these three questions, I mean, I'm sure that you get lots of – I mean, I get people sending me, I'm a comedy writer. I'm an aspiring comedy writer in Lincoln, Nebraska. What do I do? You know, I mean – and I don't necessarily mean like the advice aspect, but I mean, what's the point of what you've been doing? I mean, where do you come out at the end of this very – very amazingly diverse experience and career.
Yeah, it's like when you're talking about what do you learn, because we have been talking about comedy, but
it could be about life too.
I was going to say
you're just so notoriously private. I didn't want to tell people about.
Well, both my parents are dead, and they both passed on too early, and it was in recent years, relatively. And there's no doubt they both, for different reasons, and what happened afterwards, to me, that's what changed my life, like having just big picture lessons. Like one lesson I learned in life was you never know what's going on with people.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to give an example. Here's one that connects the two world. My mom committed suicide. So that's a topic I didn't even think of before she did. And I wouldn't care. It was because it wasn't in my life. And that's the way most people move through life. If something isn't affecting your life, you're not thinking about it too much.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably just don't really care in a true empathetic way. And especially we're going back to 20-year-olds who are like in comedy and you just – I'll fucking say anything. I just want to be funny. I'll be outrageous. I'll make fun of anything and everything and go anywhere with my comedy because I just do not give a fuck. And I think at some point, as you start to mature as a comedian, you find an empathy where you have to realize my audience isn't me. And I can affect the way they feel beyond comedy. I can make them sad and by offending them or making them feel less than about themselves. Maybe a better way to put it than being offended.
Yeah, alienated because you're not thinking about their needs. You're only thinking about your needs.
Right. So after my mom committed suicide, all of a sudden, everything on stage was suicide. I started noticing and people making fun of it. And being glib about it and cavalier and it being in comedy. It's like when you learn a word that you hadn't.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden you start seeing it everywhere. And you're like, haven't I noticed this word before?
Yeah.
It was the same thing with suicide. And I was like, but then that opened me up to like other things that maybe didn't affect me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you got to start thinking about that.
Yeah.
That you don't know what's going on with people. And that can apply to an audience or that can apply to someone you're working with who seems really dark for 6 months. And you're like, I think I used to would either write them off or go, what an asshole. Whereas now it's like, I don't know. Who knows what they're going through? Because I know people didn't know what I was going through and how it affected me. So I try to be empathetic to that.
Yeah.
And then that can go into comedy too. Like, I don't know who's in the audience, what they've been through. I really got to know that whatever I'm going to say, I would be comfortable with whatever topic I'm talking about, whatever type of person I'm talking about, life experience. If a person that has that life experience or is that type of person in the audience, I should be comfortable saying this bit in front of them without feeling bad that I might be offending them.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean no jokes about suicide, but it's like, realize some people in the audience might either be contemplating suicide or know someone who had it, or yeah. So just be careful.
Yeah.
But that applies to everything.
Well, so. That's why I think this controversy about PC culture killing comedy, and mm-hmm. that comedy is supposed to be free and not have any concerns about offending people. That's just, you're talking about a grown-up attitude, and you're saying like, yeah, sure, say whatever you want, but you got to accept the consequences. You got to accept the responsibility of what you're saying. And I think that this notion that comics should say whatever the fuck they want, it's usually a cover for being not particularly original and just being boring and mm-hmm. saying offensive shit because you think, you know, just stupid bro humor. But it also, too, is a very unevolved, very immature way of communicating. And
I'm right in the middle of this, of when I read all these opinions on this.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because I don't like to censor people either.
Me neither.
And but that's why I don't like to say certain topics are off limits. I don't like to say certain words are off limits. It's all about context. And that's why I feel like that test I'm saying is, you want to do that crazy Asian accent? Would you do that in the face of an Asian person?
Mm-hmm.
If you would, then that means you're either a sociopath and you hate Asian people.
Yeah.
Or you feel that your joke is crafted in a way that it isn't offensive to them.
Yeah.
And that they should realize that.
Yeah.
That's the way I'm putting it.
Yeah.
It's like, and I could go back through my own material and take out a lot and go, I don't know if I would say that in front of that person.
Yeah, of course.
So that's me tying real life to comedy, I guess, in a lesson.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm still learning. How many lessons do you learn that you don't follow, though?
Right.
I got a few of those.
Or
in
that
my
you
pocket.
Forget. Or that you forget too. Like I constantly be like, oh yeah, right. I remembered that thing, and I learned that thing a while ago, and I was just fucking it up over and over, and now I remember I learned it again. All right. Well, we've talked for a long time.
I know. We're such old friends.
Because I love you. And this is really fun. And
okay, I hope I scored well on the three questions. Please grade me,
you
folks. At Matt Besser, send me my score. Yeah,
you got a 7. I don't know out of what, but you got a 7.
7.
Yeah. All right, well, that's it. You people have heard enough. Go outside now, you podcast listeners.
Yeah, but watch my special while you're outside.
Yeah. Yeah, get a virtual
Apple TV.
Put your VR headset on and go sit in the park and watch Pot Humor. All right. Well, thank you, Matt Besser. I love
thanks,
you.
Thanks, Andy.
And thank you, listeners. I love you, too. And
really?
We will.
All of them?
There's that one guy, but... We will see you next time, hear you next time, be with you next time on The Three Questions.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galit Sahayak, and engineered by Will Becton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at tmobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at tmobile.com.